For over 70 years, Littleton has been helping people just like you sell their coins and currency. Whether you're an experienced collector or someone who needs help identifying what you have in your collection, Littleton Coin Company is the place to sell your U.S. coins and currency. The process is incredibly simple. Visit littletoncoin.com/majority to learn more.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, August 29th, 30th. One of those two. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Folks, we are on vacation. But we're not on vacation from providing you the very best in long-form interviews of authors, of activists on occasion, writers, journalists, thinkers. And today is no exception. A really incredible book. Very important. I want to say it's a forgotten piece of American history, but that would be redundant because that's actually in the subtitle of the book. The book is The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America by Richard Rothstein. And this book, I think, is so important because we have talked really over the past couple of weeks, in particular, when you had this understanding, a greater understanding of what the implications of these Confederate statues were. They were pushback following Reconstruction. They symbolized, in many respects, the pushback, the white pushback from Reconstruction. The generation, the beginning of Jim Crow law and Jim Crow era. And that was manifested in these statues to otherwise treasonous people, but a celebration of the subjugation of black people in this country. And last week, we spoke about the rules that took place in the 30s, or I should say the policies of the war on poverty, which melded into the war on crime and the notion that poverty was a function of culture and the implications for African Americans in this country. When there was this perspective that there was a cultural problem, and we're not going to fix any of the sort of context in which poverty and deprivation exists in this country. And much of that came out of crime and anger and despair that was in urban environments. Well, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, is the antecedent to those problems in urban America in many respects, when there was a deliberate creation of segregated communities, neighborhoods, housing developments, and all the implications that follow from that. And by deliberate, not just, you know, some private individuals were making this choice. It was a national, federal program. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Richard Rothstein about his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. And make sure you tune in. Members will have a program tomorrow. We will have no free show tomorrow, Thursday, but we will be back on Friday with Professor Robin Kelly to talk about communist organizing in Alabama in the 20s And also another bonus interview about Big Pharma's sort of myth of expired drugs. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Richard Rothstein. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of Our How Our Government Segregated America, a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute, Richard Rothstein. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So let's start here. And I have to say, I think your work here is fascinating. And it really fits into sort of a larger mosaic, and maybe mosaic's not the right word because this is somewhat linear, history of where we are in terms of, particularly in terms of race and the state of, in particular, the African-American community in this country now. But let's start with Milliken v. Bradley and explain to us why, in many respects, your book disproves, or I should say, is contrary to what the ruling in that case was.
Well, I think disproves is a good choice of words. That ruling was that you could not implement a desegregation plan in the city of Detroit and its suburbs because the suburbs had nothing to do with the fact that African Americans were living in segregated neighborhoods in Detroit. And that's factually untrue. The history of the 20th century government policy is that government policy explicitly assigned African Americans to urban areas and whites to suburbs. This was open, explicit government policy. And the notion that these suburbs happened to be all white for no reason of government action is simply false. And in fact, in the Milliken v. Bradley decision, much evidence was submitted to the court, to the lower court, demonstrating that the government action, unconstitutional government action, had been responsible for creating segregated suburbs in Detroit. That evidence was simply ignored at the Supreme Court level.
All right, so let's go back to when this this de jure, I guess, segregation, that is government-sponsored as opposed to de facto, which would be that's just the way that people congregate for whatever reasons. What was the first major piece of legislation or policy that began to create this segregation?
Well, as you said, there's a popular myth that this all happened not just because people's choices of where to live, but because of private discrimination that the government was not responsible for. There were many, many government policies that designated different areas of metropolitan areas by race, but perhaps the most powerful one initial one was the New Deal's public housing program. Before the New Deal, before the Depression and the Roosevelt administration, there was no civilian public housing in this country. The civilian public housing was first initiated by the Public Works Administration in the New Deal, and it frequently segregated communities that had never known segregation before. Frequently, what the Public Works Administration did to create public housing was demolish integrated neighborhoods, because there were many integrated neighborhoods in the country at that time in metropolitan areas, simply because workers of both races and different ethnicities had to live close enough to their workplaces to be able to get to work without automobiles. And so you had many integrated urban neighborhoods. The Public Works Administration demolished many of those neighborhoods in places like St. Louis and Atlanta and Cleveland and Cambridge, Massachusetts, in order to build segregated public housing, separate projects for whites and blacks that created patterns of segregation that hadn't existed before, or at least had not existed to nearly that extent, and were consolidated by this government action. And this went on throughout the 1930s in the Public Works Administration, and then later with the United States Housing Authority. And then it really ramped up during World War II, when hundreds of thousands of workers flocked to centers of defense production throughout the country in order to keep the military supply lines going. And the federal government had to build housing for those workers because the explosion of population in centers of defense production was so great that there was no housing available. And if workers didn't have a place to live, the war machine would have shut down. So the federal government built housing in centers of defense production and created segregation again where it hadn't existed before. In my book, The Color of Law, I describe a community in Northern California, Richmond, which was the center of shipbuilding production in the nation at that time. This community had a population of less than 20,000 before World War II. By the end of World War II, it was 100,000. No community can absorb that kind of population in 4 years without massive government intervention. And the government did intervene and built public housing for African Americans along the railroad tracks in the industrial area. It built public housing for white workers in the more residential white areas further inland. This was a community that had very few African Americans living in it before World War II. There were a few domestic servants there. But it certainly cannot be claimed that the government was simply reinforcing pre-existing patterns of segregation. It was created by the government at that time. And this went on all across the country. In Willow Run in Michigan, a center of bomber production, was a factory that was built in order to produce military aircraft during the war. It was in a rural area. Nobody was living there. The federal government built housing for white workers only, creating a segregated community that hadn't existed before. So that was one major policy.
And let me just ask you one more question about that before we move on to the to the FHA. When we talk about the Public Works Administration, where they would tear down places and then rebuild a public housing, you know, segregated public housing, how much of the intent was to segregate and how much of it was, hey, this is the way that we rebuild?
Well, but why would that be the way to rebuild? You could easily have created integrated public housing.
Oh, no. The primary, I'm just trying to get a sense of the primary impetus was that we was not necessarily to segregate, but was specifically to create public housing. And then the idea was, of course, when we create this public housing, it should be segregated.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. Of course, the purpose of the Public Works Administration was not primarily to create segregation. The purpose of the Public Works Administration was to create housing in during the Depression, when there was an enormous housing shortage, and also to provide construction jobs during the Depression for workers who were unemployed. But within that broader framework, when it did create housing, it created it on a segregated basis, and it cannot be claimed that it was simply following community patterns, because it frequently created segregation where it hadn't existed before. In my book, I tell one story of Langston Hughes, the great African-American poet, who describes how as an adolescent, he grew up in an integrated Cleveland neighborhood. It says his best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl. Well, that neighborhood was later demolished in part by the Public Works Administration in order to build segregated public housing, one project for African-Americans, one project for whites in a community that was about half black and half white prior to that event. So this went on. This is not a Southern phenomenon. This is as the example I just gave in Cleveland indicates. This went on around the country, the North, the Midwest, the West, as well as the South. I describe another example in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where the federal government pursued a similar policy of creating segregated public housing in what had previously been an integrated neighborhood.
And I think I know that that neighborhood sometime between somewhere between Central and Inman Square. I spent some time there as in my youth. But so let me ask you this. So the it's important to note that this was not just a Southern policy, because we know that in the development of Social Security as part of the New Deal, that African Americans and I would say also Latinos and or Hispanics and in some respects women were left out by the choices of professions, or I should say jobs that were covered under the Social Security system, and that the story that we are told about that was a an attempt to negotiate with Southern with Dixiecrats to get the Social Security system up and running. But how do we square that understanding of Social Security with this in terms of the Public Works Administration? And then we can move on to the FHA.
Well, they're completely consistent. The Social Security system is a national system, and occupations were excluded based on whether they were predominantly African American, as you say, at the insistence of Southern Democratic Congress people. But housing is not a national system. Just as the South, Southern Democrats, Southern legislators, didn't insist on national school segregation. They only wanted to segregate schools in their own community. And schools in the North had integration at the time when the South was segregated. Similarly, even if the Southern legislators, Southern congressmen, had insisted that the Public Works Administration build segregated public housing in their communities, they would have had no reason to insist, and didn't insist, that segregated public housing be built in Cambridge or in Cleveland. That was not their concern. Their only concern was segregation in their own states. It was necessary to exclude, on a national basis, occupations in which African Americans predominated in order to affect Social Security segregation in the South. And the same thing, by the way, was done with the Fair Labor Standards Act, with the minimum wage law, and with the National Labor Relations Act, where agricultural workers were excluded, because these were national categories. But there's no reason to think that Southern Democrats would have cared whether Northern housing was integrated, just as they didn't care that Northern schools were integrated.
And so let's move on to the Federal Housing Administration, which is the second major, I guess, program that functioned to that was discriminatory in its functioning.
Yes, this was the other side of the picture. And of course, there are many, many policies that were implemented, but these were the two major ones: public housing and then the actions of the Federal Housing Administration. Many people are familiar with the fact that the Federal Housing Administration redlined African-American communities and refused to insure mortgages for African-Americans in predominantly black neighborhoods. That's true, but that was not the major effect of the Federal Housing Administration policies. A far more powerful policy of the Federal Housing Administration was to guarantee bank loans for mass production builders to create suburbs throughout the country. Subdivisions for whites only that encircled central cities. This was an explicit program of the federal government to suburbanize the white population to the exclusion of African Americans. And connecting these two programs, by the 1950s, when the civilian housing shortage had abated and there was civilian housing again available, whites were able to leave public housing. It had previously been primarily for whites with some black projects. African Americans had to remain. And so you had long waiting lists for African American projects and vacancies in white projects. The reason for that is the Federal Housing Administration was subsidizing whites to leave public housing as well as other rental units in cities and move to suburbs. So perhaps the best known example of this is Levittown, just east of New York City. The Levitt could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes for which he had no buyers. without federal government guarantees. And so Levitt was able to go to the federal government, to the Federal Housing Administration, submit his plans for this subdivision, and then get the Federal Housing Administration's endorsement that he could take the banks in order to get construction loans. And that endorsement was conditioned on his refusal to sell homes to African Americans. And indeed, the FHA also required that in order to get this guarantee of bank loans, that Levitt include a clause in every deed in Levittown prohibiting resale to African Americans. And again, this was a national program. Suburbs in every metropolitan area in the country were created in this way on a whites-only basis. Some of your listeners may recall hearing Pete Seeger sing a Malvina Reynolds song about houses on a hillside made of ticky-tacky. Well, that's about a suburb south of San Francisco, created in the early 1950s, late 1940s, by a builder, Henry Dolger, like Levitt, couldn't have assembled the capital without FHA support, on a whites-only basis with restrictive covenants attached to the deed of every home in that development. In Los Angeles, south of Los Angeles, the great a center of suburbanization in the country in the 1950s, places like Lakewood, south of Los Angeles, or Panorama City in the San Fernando Valley. Those were created with similar FHA guarantees on condition that no homes were sold to African Americans. And so in California, in New York, and in every metropolitan area in between, you had the FHA explicitly suburbanizing the white population. And prohibiting African Americans from following the whites who moved out of public housing into these white-only suburbs. And they were very modest homes they were moving into. Paid less on their FHA or VA monthly mortgage payments than they were paying in rent in public housing prior to this FHA action. So this was a massive subsidy of suburbanization. And together with the public housing program, it created what later observers called a white noose that was created by the federal government around African-American neighborhoods in central cities. So, and we're living with the effects of these federal policies today.
I think it's, you know, just I don't know. I don't know how people hear this, but it's really shocking, I think, for folks, because this is, I mean, I know it's the it's the subtitle of your book, but it really is. I think there's just the awareness of that type of proactive measures by the government to enforce segregation at that date. The federal government, I think, is I find it pretty obviously disturbing, but sort of a bit shocking because it's been so absent from the discourse. So let me ask you this. Based on that, what was the interest of the federal government to suburbanize the white population?
Well, the federal government's interest in having families move from rented apartments to single family homes actually began in the early 20th century, right after World War I, where the federal government came up with the idea that if renters became homeowners, they couldn't become communists because people who owned their own homes would have a property interest that would prevent them from being attracted to communism. So that's where it all started, and then it built from there. Why did the federal government insist on this single-family home obsession being implemented on a racial basis? Well, I think you have to remember that the federal government, really up until Kennedy's election in 1960 and even after that, was a government that was run by a ruling elite that was a uniformly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and had assumptions about racial inferiority that were not restricted to Southerners. This is the same the Roosevelt administration, which did some very important progressive things in economic policy. You know, African Americans benefited from the Roosevelt administration because they got economic benefits, though less than whites got, that were more than they've ever had before. But the Roosevelt administration is the same administration that refused to admit Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany because of its racial superiority assumptions. So the fact that they had these assumptions about racial inferiority of African Americans shouldn't be surprising once you think about it. This was not restricted to Southerners. This was a, you know, I don't know how much to attribute to this, but, you know, Woodrow Wilson was the first Southern Democrat to be elected to the presidency after the World War, after the Civil War. And Wilson implemented a program of segregating the federal government. Previously, the civil service had been integrated. There were many African-Americans working in the civil service, some as supervisors. Wilson administered a program that to segregate the federal civil service, to demote any African-American who was in a position of supervisory position over whites. Well, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, who during the Woodrow Wilson administration was responsible for implementing this policy, was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't say that he was in favor of the policy, but he certainly didn't object to it when he was implementing it. And this was, again, the assumption of the ruling elites of this country, which was uniform nationally, not restricted to the South.
And so we have the FHA essentially enforces these covenants that they leverage by offering the financing for this suburbanization. And so they are passed down by the time the individual who wants to sell their house years later sees it, they assume it's sort of some type of private thing, right? I mean, it was almost like it was hidden even almost contemporaneously, or was it?
Well, it wasn't hidden. Everybody who bought their home in Levittown knew that it had such a deed. And as the Supreme Court belatedly recognized, and I want to emphasize that all of these policies were unconstitutional. They didn't become unconstitutional only when the Supreme Court woke up and recognized it. But the Supreme Court belatedly recognized that these covenants depended on state court enforcement. You could have a private covenant between two people, but you couldn't get an African-American evicted from a home that he bought in violation of a covenant. And there were thousands of examples of these evictions across the country of African-Americans who moved into white neighborhoods because the housing shortage was so serious for African-Americans. They frequently were willing to pay more for housing than whites paid for similar housing. And so many white homeowners who wanted to sell were more than willing to sell to African-Americans despite these covenants. And then neighboring white homeowners would sue to have the African-American evicted. And that eviction couldn't take place unless state courts intervened. So this was a state involvement in the enforcement of these contracts, which was equally unconstitutional as the other policies I've described. So while there was a widespread belief that these were simply private agreements, they weren't private because a legal agreement requires state involvement to enforce. It wouldn't have any power if it weren't for the courts. So through the enforcement of covenants, through the policies of the FHA, through the policies of other public housing agencies, and through many, many other policies I describe in the book, we had an unconstitutional system of residential segregation, which went unrecognized for many years, although the individual policies were recognized.
Right.
And the failure to understand this constitutional system hobbles our ability to deal with the enormous problems that result in our country today from residential segregation. Because so long as we believe that all of this happened just by accident or by private choices or by personal prejudice, it's very hard to think of the millions of private decisions in opposite direction that might undo it. But if we understand that this whole system of residential segregation was an unconstitutional system imposed by government, then it follows that there's a constitutional obligation to implement policies that are equally powerful to undo it. So understanding this history is essential to a program to undo it.
I want to I don't want to, you know, I want to be able to circle back to this for one moment, but I would just add, you know, on this program, we've had multiple interviews where we've talked about the accumulation of wealth and how much of that is a function of housing through the years. And so the implications of of not only in terms of wealth inequality that this led to, also last week we spoke about the implications of the war on poverty in the carceral state, which grew out of ghettos, essentially, that were developed, I think, probably in many respects, as a function of these policies that did not manifest themselves until 10, 15, 20 years later in terms of what it did to these communities. Because you also talk about the underwriting manual of the FHA would suggest the development of highways to further segregate these neighborhoods.
Well, yes, you have a number of questions there. Let me take them separately if I can.
Sure. Sorry about that.
The FHA issued an underwriting manual beginning in the mid-1930s, which not only prohibited the recommendation by appraisers of a home for FHA insurance if there were incompatible racial groups in the neighborhood, but it also had a variety of recommendations about how to preserve the whiteness of neighborhoods in order to make them eligible for insurance. One of them, as you say, was recommending that arterial routes, highways, be routed in such a way as to separate black from white neighborhoods. And we see an example of that in the, for example, the Dan Ryan Expressway in Chicago, whose route was selected for the purpose of separating black from white communities. But for a variety of other ways, in one case, a builder in Detroit wanted to build a white subdivision within the city of Detroit, and the FHA refused to insure his loans for that subdivision unless he built a 6-foot-high wall, cement wall, concrete wall that went a half mile long to separate that subdivision from a nearby African-American neighborhood. I have a picture of that wall in my book. The FHA recommended that not only highways be built, it recommended that the zoning laws be used to exclude lower income families from subdivisions. It recommended, of course, restrictive covenants. So that's one aspect of the underwriting manual that FHA appraisers relied upon throughout the country beginning in the 1930s to implement segregation. You mentioned wealth. In my book, I describe, for example, places, and I'll use this example again, Levittown, but you could use it for any subdivision like that anywhere in the country. Those homes in the mid-20th century sold for about, well, it was about $9,000, $8,000 in those terms. Today, it's about from $75,000 to $100,000. So the white families who were able to move out of public housing or out of rental housing into subdivisions like Levittown paid in today's dollars about $100,000. Well, today those homes sell for a minimum of $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. Working class families in 1950 could afford to buy a home for $100,000. It's about twice national median income. Returning war veterans, working class families, white working class families bought those homes in Levittown. They were affordable. Today, those homes in Levittown are no longer affordable to working class families. They were sold, as I say, in the mid-20th century for about twice national median income, $100,000. Today, they're being sold for 6-7 times national median income, unaffordable to working class families. So undoing this history of residential segregation is a little bit more complicated than simply passing a law giving African Americans the right now to move into places like Levittown, because it's when they would have been able to do so 60, 70 years ago, it's unaffordable for working class families today. The result is that the white families who moved into those homes in the mid-20th century and their children and grandchildren accumulated, the homes now selling for $400,000 and bought them for $100,000. Maybe they did a little bit of home improvement, so they gained $300,000 in equity in that period of time when they eventually sold their homes. And they used that equity to fund their retirements, to send their children to college, to take care of medical emergencies. African Americans who were forced, because they were not permitted to move into single-family homes in suburbs, to live in rented apartments, accumulated none of that equity. The result is that today, African-American average incomes are about 60% of white average incomes. But African-American wealth is about 5 to 7% of white wealth. And that enormous difference, a 60% income ratio and a 5 to 7% wealth ratio, is almost entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century.
And how much, once these segregated neighborhoods are created, there seems to me to be also a sort of a cascading effect of policies that become much easier to execute in terms of providing lesser services to African Americans by way of underfunding schools, and then, you know, locating things like, I don't know, refineries or power stations. I mean, how much of that has what was codified on a federal level? I mean, I guess, you know, in schools we're talking about property values in terms of taxation, but broadly speaking, I mean, how much were there subsidiary policies that were a function of that first policy to make sure that there was active segregation?
Well, there were many government policies that contributed to the systematic unconstitutional practice of residential segregation, not all of them at the federal level. So you're correct that once African Americans were crowded into ghettos, which with fewer housing options outside of these designated African American neighborhoods, then there were places that cities and zoning boards placed toxic waste facilities and industrial facilities. In many cases, you had cities where virtually all of the industrial and toxic waste sites were in African-American neighborhoods and few, if any, in white neighborhoods. Well, this wasn't a federal policy. This was a local zoning policy, but it was equally unconstitutional, equal violation of the 14th Amendment as opposed to federal government policies of segregation, which violated the 5th Amendment, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. So this was local policies. There were other federal policies. One of them that I talk about in my book is the Internal Revenue Service, which granted tax exemptions to non-profit institutions that practiced residential segregation. An example I write about is the University of Chicago, where Robert Hutchins, a well-known education reformer, advocate of a liberal education curriculum. Robert Hutchins was the president of the University of Chicago in the mid-20th century. He had an office in his office of the presidency whose role was to sue homeowners who sold homes to African Americans in the vicinity of the University of Chicago to have those African Americans evicted because they bought the homes in violation of a restrictive covenant. Well, the University of Chicago continued to enjoy its tax exemption, even though this policy was blatant and open and nothing hidden about it. The IRS today recognizes that it cannot grant a tax exemption to an institution that promotes residential or racial segregation of any kind. It didn't become unconstitutional for the IRS to do this only now. It was unconstitutional for the entire period. But they did it nonetheless. There were local government, many other local government policies. The police frequently were complicit or organized in some cases, mobs that firebombed homes of African Americans who moved into white neighborhoods. This was also a constitutional violation. So there were many, many of these policies that were implemented by government at all levels. And many of them, virtually all of them, have been known. As I said, the subtitle of my book is A Forgotten History. It wasn't hidden. But what hasn't been recognized is that all together, they fit together as a system. And it's that system that has created the residential segregation of every metropolitan area in this country. and that needs to be remedied.
I want to talk about that remedy because you you emphasize the unconstitutional nature of these policies. And obviously there's a real problem with them morally, but the fact that they were unconstitutional, are unconstitutional, sets up what in terms of what of how this can be remedied?
Well, you're correct. It is, of course, a moral outrage. The subjugation of African Americans, whether from slavery or from segregation, is a moral outrage. But the important point of my book, or one of the important points, is that because it's also a constitutional violation, we have an obligation, a legal obligation, to remedy it. We certainly have a moral obligation to do a lot of things that we don't do, but we actually have a legal obligation to remedy residential segregation. But we're not going to embark on those remedies unless there's a much broader understanding in this country of how government created the system in an unconstitutional fashion. And so I think that while I do have lots of ideas about what remedies might look like, they're all non-starters because we all think, or most of us think still today, that we have a de facto system of segregation which doesn't require a remedy, even though it might be a nice thing to have. And so the first step has to be a dissemination of this history. And you know, my book is not the only one talking about this. Others are doing so, but there needs to be a dissemination of this history so we can have a new consensus in this country about a problem that requires a remedy. And once we have that consensus, we can begin to have the kinds of conversations necessary to devise the remedies, which in many cases will be very, very difficult, but need to be done.
Why do you think this history was forgotten? I mean, you know, I mean, I think there's a broad awareness of there were segregation among schools. I think there's, you know, a broad awareness of segregation in things like water fountains or, you know, in you know, where you could go stay at a hotel or something like that. Why do you think this particular history was forgotten?
I think it's been forgotten primarily because it's so difficult to deal with. It's, as you say, if you, you know, we passed the law, civil rights laws in the 1960s that prohibited discrimination in hotels. And the next day you could stay in any hotel if the law was enforced. We prohibited segregation in water fountains. And once that was done, you could drink from any water fountain you wanted. We prohibited discrimination on buses. And the next day you could sit on any seat. I could go on and on. Even when we prohibited discrimination in schools, you could attend your neighborhood school. Schools remain segregated, not because segregation of schools remains, but because the neighborhoods in which they're located are segregated. But if we prohibit segregation in housing, as we have done, the Fair Housing Act prohibits ongoing discrimination in housing. The next day, the landscape looks pretty much the same. Some African Americans are able to move into white neighborhoods, but basically, as I talked about earlier, the communities that were created as white-only suburbs are now unaffordable to working-class families. So a lot more needs to be done than simply prohibiting segregation. And since it is such a difficult problem to deal with, it's easier to forget about how it was created than to confront the unconstitutional system with its obligation to remedy it.
Richard Rothstein, the book is The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. I can't thank you enough. It's a fascinating a book and really, obviously, an incredibly important piece of history that people need to be aware of. And I appreciate your coming on to talk about it.
Thank you very much.